Fabulous. Okay, today what we're going to do is a little bit of show and tell. We're going to go into the church, and I'm going to explain everything that's in there and why it's in there. And so oftentimes what happens, people are so used to seeing stuff that they don't ever ask, why do we have that? What does that mean? And so you'll probably learn a lot of stuff that is completely useless, that nobody wants to know, but I had to learn it, so you do too. So, but anyway, in appreciating our heritage, I have a collection of things, and I'm going to pass them around so you can see. I think it's always helpful. I don't know if it is for you, but I like to touch history. Mm-hmm. I don't like to hear about it. So when I was in West Virginia, I think I've told some of you this story, we had a lady, wonderful, oh my God, I love to go visit her. And she was a doctor's wife. They endowed the medical school at WVU. So that'll give you an idea of what ballpark we're talking about. And they never had children, and her husband was a doctor and just owned thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of property. And so over the years, they sold it off and gave a ton of money to charity. But she became a pen pal with a guy who was a curator at the Coventry Cathedral Museum in London. And, you know, they corresponded. I mean, she has had a closet full of correspondence. I'm talking shoeboxes that went floor to ceiling. And he had, like, six kids and was never able to travel. And she had no children and traveled all the time. So they corresponded and it just had this incredible friendship. And he sent her a, I think it was 1585 version of the Breeches Bible. It had a leather cover with brass hinges. I mean, it was just this incredible book. And every time I would, when I was there and I would start talking about the Reformation, I'd say, let's touch it, shall we? So I don't own anything that old, but the Episcopal Church obviously comes out of the Church of England. And the Church of England, interestingly enough, in her entire history, just adopted their fifth prayer book. The one that they were using up until just recently was the 1662. Now, this is not a 1662 version, but a part of the reason that I have this size is that the notion of the church owning prayer books and providing them did not come about until after the First World War. If you were an Episcopalian, you bought your own. Mm-hmm. You brought them with you to church. You took them with you when you went home. And much to my surprise, when I went to do a funeral in Australia and got to preach at a couple of churches, I was very surprised to see in the church that there were no like book racks or anything like that in the pews, that when you walk in, if you don't have one, they'll hand you a book with the very clear understanding, when you leave, you hand it back. So there's kind of this expression or understanding that you have one. So most of these are devotional. This is a modern one. It's still the 1662 prayer book, but this is the sort of gift that was given to a bride when she was married. And this particular one was from a wedding that got called off. And you don't need to know that story. But they wanted to be married under the 1662 Book of Common Prayer. It was a huge issue. They were both British. And they subsequently went on to marry other people. But anyway, so she said, well, I don't want this because it reminds me of what's his name. So I said, well, that's okay. I'll hold on to it. Other books, these were official prayer books. There was a 1549, 1552, 1559, and then 1662. So these were the official ones up until just recently. The church also published devotional prayer books. These are not, they're the same. Just, and a part of the reason I wanted to show you is that these are both the same year. Okay. They were both printed in 1947. But you can obviously see this one was on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And this one was used and loved.
Yes.
So that's the British section. There were also things that were published like this, because the cost of a book like this up until fairly recently was about a week's salary. So they started putting out things that were like this, that this was just the communion service, and that was about a day's salary. So these were more available for common people. They also put out little devotionals, and in just a moment you'll see, these are just a couple of examples of things that would be put out. When we got to the United States, obviously we didn't want to pray for the Queen or, you know, any of that sort of stuff. And so although the church was established, the Episcopal Church was established in 1607, we didn't, of course, break away until the Revolutionary War. And then during the Revolutionary War, when it was over, they adopted a 1789 prayer book. That is what this is. Okay? So be very careful. It's in horrible shape.
Yeah.
But again, these would be the size that the clergy would use.
Wow.
This particular one was a clergyman's. And this size, likewise, was the clergy size. This was your size.
Yeah.
This is a prayer book and a hymnal.
Oh, my.
Okay, now, I don't know what these people ate, where they thought they could see, or you had to memorize stuff because you could not possibly deal with this. But one of the reason that I love this, this particular one, is a prayer book that was authorized in 1886. But one of the reason I wanted to show it to you is if you look through it, you'll see that it has some fascinating services. Baptism of those of riper years is the name of one of them. There's also a rite for the visitation of prisoners. I mean, there's just a lot of really cool stuff. And you'll notice that the way this is bound.
Oh, wow.
Okay, they were actually separate, but there was a little envelope, and this doesn't come off. This is bound that way. But this would have been something that very good church people would have had. And a part of the reason that they were this size, and you see these are, again, I can only afford stuff that's in really bad shape. And a lot of this was given to me. Yeah.
I just happened to turn in this one, I'm sure, which
one is it?
The spiritual communion.
Yes, that was the one I was talking about. That's from the St. Augustine prayer book. Right. This is one that is, I'm giving them to you in newer years, 1876. So these would have been the 1789 version, but updated and modernized. Okay. This particular set, again, it's a set. It wasn't bound the way the other one was. These were completely separate. And I find it interesting. You can tell a lot about people's spirituality because the prayer book is much more worn than the hymnal. Mm-hmm. So obviously this person didn't like to sing a whole lot. But this particular version, and again, in horrible shape, is actually the 1892 prayer book and the 1892 hymnal. Up to that time, this was fairly normal. This was fairly typical. Prayer books were often handed down from generation to generation, or as soon as you got to the point where you couldn't read the little print anymore, I'm sure they passed them on. But just to give you an idea of the worth or the value of these, this set here is worth about $200 now. That one right there, the 1789 prayer book, is actually worth about $350. And then the successive ones, all between $75 and $100, just because they're in horrible shape. But I've already alerted my wife that if something ever happens to me, make sure you find these and pass them on to our son.
Oh, yeah.
These have the gospel. This one has the gospel.
Yes. And again, remember, a part of this is, and for those of you who know about life on the frontier, the primary way that people learn to read and write English was by reading the Bible.
Yeah.
They used the McGuffey readers, they used to teach morals and instruction and Bible, you know, truths. Obviously we don't do that anymore. But a part of the reason that these are so widely worn and used is that these became, on the frontier, textbooks that the parents could actually use so they could see how their kids were reading. The next one is the 1928 prayer book, and that's worth about $2. They are not, everybody's getting rid of those, so maybe in a few years they'll be worth something.
Yeah.
But the 1928 prayer book served the church quite well. All of the ones that you're seeing now, when the church adopted the prayer book, the first time anyone saw it was at the convention. Okay? Up to that point, there was a small select group of people. They were predominantly seminary professors and, you know, bishops and people like that who were interested in liturgy. The whole notion of what we're getting ready to go into in the 1970s was absolutely never tried before. In 1928, when that prayer book was adopted, there were those who said, we want to make sure that it's not so long before we get another prayer book. So from 1898 to 1928, that's 30 years, okay? The need for one, they wrote it, they got it published, they got it passed by two successive general conventions in 30 years, okay? 50 years later, the church had still not adopted a new one. But in the early 1970s, they came out with this. And I'm going to tell you a little story about this. The Green Book, as it was lovingly called, the Green Book was the first prayer book to have multiple Eucharistic prayers, write one, write two, all of this stuff. And most bishops took one look at it, threw it out the window, and said, when the church adopts a prayer book, I'll let you have it. So in the diocese that I was living at when I was a child, our bishop would not allow this to be used. Okay? So while we knew about services for trial use, this actually came out when I was a sophomore in high school. We learned about it. We heard about it. The internet wasn't out. If you wanted to see it, you had to go to a public library or find an Episcopal church that had a rector that had just moved from the north. Wow. After the Green Book came what was lovingly referred to as the Zebra Book. 2 years later, the Zebra Book came out. And it's interesting that both the Church of England prayer books and the Episcopal prayer books, once they are adopted, they immediately go into the public domain. So there is a person who is known as the custodian of the Book of Common Prayer, who is responsible for seeing each successive printing is exactly identical to the one before it. And I think that would be a terribly boring job. But anyway, Charles Mortimer Gilbert was it forever. I don't know who it is now.
Why do I know that name?
He was the... his name is printed in the front flap of most of the prayer books. After the Zebra Book came out, and this one, if you think people didn't like the Green Book, this was worse. We came to what was lovingly known as the Blue Book. And the Blue Book was a book that was put out as a study document for General Convention 1976. So one of the reasons why I have this one and a couple of other ones that I'll show you in just a second is these were actual convention documents. And so what happened, if you look at this prayer book and you compare it to this prayer book, you'll see that it's off by a page. Okay? And one of the reasons that I know that is we heard from someone, and I don't know if this is true. This is apocryphal, but it sounds like something that the church would dream up. I believe in that book, turn to page 359. In this particular document, it's two pages off. We have several printing companies, the Church Publishing, Morehouse, the Church Hymnal Corporation, there are several different, Seabury, prints, a lot of them. But we have different printers, okay? When this one came out, and you're going to love this logic, they thought the pagination was difficult for people to remember. Now, I don't know where they got that from, but one of the driving pieces of the page change was they wanted the confession and absolution to be on page 360. Instead of, in some versions, it was on 362 and some on 359. And they said, well, Episcopalians will know that 360 degrees is a full, complete circle. So they will know after they are absolved of their sins and they are full and complete. So we need to adapt things around so that the confession and absolution are on page 360. Now, only the church could think of stupid stuff like that.
Well, it makes sense to me.
But it's now on page 360, and right one begins on 355, right 323, right two on 355. These books that I'm going to pass out to you are the current one. It was adopted at General Convention 1976, and then this particular one, which is the one I got rebound at the library, is actually a 1979 prayer book. Okay? And a part of the craziness of this is I actually use this as a textbook, and so I wrote my notes from liturgics class in it. So I'm always very careful. I don't care where all my other stuff is, but that one, and my son has already spoken for this one.
That's on his list.
Very cool. Yeah. I'm sure you refer to this frequently.
I do quite often.
This is nice.
These are all current ones, and we're going to actually use these for the next exercise. And I would like for you to turn, and all of our pages will be the same on this one. Page 413. When the bishop is here, this is actually the service that we will use. Now, it will all be printed up in the magic little bulletin. And, of course, one of the reasons why I made sure that you noted that it's in the public domain is we're not violating the copyright by doing the bulletins the way that we do them. That's my craziness. A lot of people like it. Some people don't like it. You don't like it, use the prayer book. Be lost. But I happen to think it's a good way of doing it because people always know where to find stuff. But the confirmation service is different. First of all, obviously the bishop will be here. We are the only denomination on the face of the earth that still requires bishops to confirm. Lutherans, Catholics, Greek Orthodox, the parish priest can confirm you. But the service, if you kind of hold your finger there and then turn back to page 299, which is the service of holy baptism, you'll see that the two services start out identically. A part of the reason for that is that if there were adults who wanted to be confirmed, that is, to make a mature public commitment to Christ, and they had not been baptized, they would be baptized by the bishop and confirmed at the same service. Okay? If you read into the rubrics of all of these services, you'll see that that is the norm. One of the huge differences that the 1979 prayer book did is it made adult baptism the norm. It used all the other ones, child infant baptism was the norm. So now the infant stuff is in italics, but we make the assumption. So if there was somebody who is going to be baptized, and we do have one person I'm still talking with, so it's not totally out of the question, but they better make up their mind soon. But anyway, you'll sit out in the congregation wherever you normally sit in your assigned seats, of course. And at the time of the confirmation, you'll each come forward. There'll be cards printed like this, and they'll have your name written out on them and, you know, all of that stuff. I've never seen Bishop Brewer confirmed, so I don't know what he does. Okay? I will, yes. Have you seen him?
No, I haven't seen him, but I have a question I wanted to ask, and I might as well ask it.
Okay, cool.
I remember when I was confirmed, one of the, oh my gosh, was that the bishop would ask you a question.
Right.
One of the umpteen questions
in the catechism.
The catechism.
They don't do that anymore. Yeah, no, no.
When I was confirmed, we always...
Okay, I've actually had seen bishops, and Bishop Hugo, he slaps you pretty good. And does anybody know why they do that? No, actually it has a much more interesting origin. It's actually a remnant from the early, much earlier liturgies, where there was actually an exorcism performed before baptism.
Really?
Or confirmation. And this was the last vestige of kind of slapping any last little bit of evil out of you. I don't know what he does. So if he slaps you, I hope it's not too hard. So the whole first part up through the sermon and all that sort of stuff will be basically the same as what you're used to. After the sermon, he'll call people up. We're not going to have a rehearsal. I think we're all, you know, we can read and pay attention. And, you know, I'll be standing up doing the motion directing because, of course, at this service, I have nothing to do. At St. Stephen's in Lakeland, we had this one lady, and she was, you know, there are just some people that should have been a comedian, and she was one of them. And every time the bishop was there, as she was walking back from communion, and she would pass me, she said, "We're not paying you for today, are we? You know, you haven't done anything." And I just look at her and smile. Yes, yes, we are. But anyway, I will be the one who is presenting you. One of the questions that some people ask was, "Do I have to have a sponsor?" No. If you want to have a sponsor, you can, but you don't have to have one. If there's someone significant that's a person of faith and you'd like them to present you to the bishop, I'm totally cool with that.
Otherwise you will?
I will do it. A lot of times spouses will present. If your godparents are still alive, this would be the final kind of thing that they would do. But for most adults, it's just the parish priest. Yep.
Let me catch up here. So even though I have been confirmed in the Episcopal Church in my hometown,
okay,
this is a confirmation for this?
No. This. Okay. You have the option, okay, and here's the options,
okay?
It's the same service, but you can be confirmed. That is, we have some people who, when they were confirmed, for those people, you know, what I say to folks is, in your heart, you know exactly what you want to do and what you need to do. So if you have never made a mature public commitment to Christ and you want to be confirmed, by all means, when hope calls you, just say, I'm going to be confirmed. If you were confirmed in the Episcopal Church or any other church if you were confirmed as a Roman Catholic or a Lutheran, that you have made a mature public commitment to Christ and you don't want to in any way denigrate that commitment that you made, then you can be received into the Episcopal Church. Now, prior to 1991, we would only receive you if you were Roman Catholic or Orthodox, like Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox, something like that, because you were confirmed by a bishop. Once we started talking to the Lutherans and the Moravians and everybody and their brother, we say, if you have made a public commitment to Christ as a Presbyterian or, you know, whatever you were, then we're going to say that you have made that commitment and we are going to simply receive you. Or if you have been confirmed and received and or, you know, any combination thereof, and you just want to use this as a reaffirmation of your faith, you can do that too. We're going to use exactly the same questions. The only thing that will differ is the prayers that the bishop says over you. So, you know, that basically is what is, and because each person is different, I just want to say that's totally your option. Okay? But, you know, I think one of the crazy things about the whole notion of confirmation, I think it's good. I think it's a good opportunity for people to make a public commitment to respond to the gospel appeal. You know, when Jesus said, "If you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father in heaven. If you deny me before man, I will deny you before my Father in heaven." So if you have any doubt, any question, you want to do that, you know, so that when you see him face to face, you can remind him about when you made your public profession. I'm sure he already knows, but for some people it's a huge issue. Especially people who come out of a more Protestant mindset. They want to be able to recall that moment that they accepted Christ. On the more Catholic or higher church side of the church, the feeling is much more, long before I accepted him, he accepted me. Mm-hmm. He was in my life working, moving, acting, doing, you know, applying leverage long before I was even remotely thinking of that. So it has to do with being a more inclusive church, and instead of me saying you need to fit into one of these nice neat little boxes, what I do is I explain to people what the difference is and say, listen to your heart. So, does that help?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So anyway, the people who are going to be baptized and or confirmed and or received and or reaffirmed will do their respective parts. They'll be presented differently, so if you don't have to run around and look at everybody's card, because you'll be able to tell who we're praying for when. There is a time at the top of 416, just as when there is a baptism, the congregation is asked, will you do all in your power to support this child in his or her life in Christ? In the confirmation service, we have a similar vow. I think it's important, especially for those of you who have been in or grown up in the church for a long time, to understand that the spirituality of this prayer book is corporate. This is not about you having your little private baptism with, you know, so-and-so on Saturday afternoon because, you know, your people just couldn't get there on Sunday. No, we do this kind of stuff Sunday morning. When Mickey Holland died, and we were, you know, looking at the juxtaposition of family and all that sort of stuff, you know, I said to Carol, if you want to have his burial service on Sunday morning at 10:15, that's totally fine. You know, we enter into the church through baptism. We should depart the church at a similar soiree. And, I mean, there's not a whole lot I haven't done. I did when I was in Lakeland, I did a funeral baptism. Woman had died. All the family were coming in, and in the process learned that somebody had, you know, moved. They moved out of state. They were looking for a church, hadn't found one yet. The kid's 2 years old, but gee, as long as we got the whole family together and we got a live one here, we'll do it. Why don't we baptize, you know, Abby at the service? And so we had a baptism, funeral, Eucharist. And it was kind of like, you know, hey, if we had a bishop, we could do all seven sacraments and we'll be fine. The baptismal covenant is basically the Apostles' Creed. There are some prayers that are said. And then the bishop prays for you. I want to tell you a story that happened at my confirmation, which I could shoot the lady who said it. So I now say exactly the opposite. I love my confirmation teacher. She was the organist of our church. She was spirit-filled before I knew what that meant. All I knew is every time I talked to Linda, I knew she had just gotten off the phone with Jesus. She had his personal phone number. And, you know, when I think about Moses' face shining, I think about Linda Coburn. I mean, she's one of the true saints of God. If she's in glory now, which she could be, I know she's got a front row seat. You know, she was an incredible, incredible woman. But she said something to us, on the eve of our confirmation when we gathered at church at 13 for the practice. And that's when they discovered I hadn't been baptized yet, so it was very awkward. And I said, so this thing where he's going to like lay his hands on us, like what's going to happen? And she said, probably nothing. And, you know, it's funny. I can remember my baptism because since I hadn't been done, we kind of had a quickie on Saturday afternoon before the bishop came. And there I stood, it terribly embarrassed with all the other little babies who were being baptized. But I'm really thrilled that it happened that way because I can remember it. And I can remember my baptism and my confirmation. My confirmation was much more important to me. And when we got to this particular part in the service, she said, you know, just don't expect a whole lot's going to happen. I mean, you know, you're in a bunch of people, you know, we're just going to kind of go down the road. He's going to hit you. He'll probably ask you a question, you know, so you better be bone up and study, but he didn't. And I remember thinking after that, even as a adolescent, this is really a bad message. You have a person who has just been elected to be the spiritual head of over 20,000 people. And, well, yes, he's just a man. I will tell you, he's an incredibly godly man. And I have had an opportunity to have lunch with him twice. And both times, I couldn't help but think, this is exactly the right person that we should have chosen. And he is wise beyond his years, and very gifted in the widest possible definition of that term. And if I were you, I would be excited that he's going to pray for you. And be open to and expect them. That's what I want to say to you. I think that so oftentimes in the church, we want to control anything that's emotional or seeming to be not just by the book and, you know, written response and the Lord be with you and also with you and all that. And I just think that there are times that we need to be more open and sensitive to the Holy Spirit moving. And I think this is one of those times. And I can tell you, if Bishop Brewer said, I want to pray for you, absolutely. He has, he does. And, you know, I was terribly impressed. But he sent me a anniversary of my ordination card. And I thought, I haven't gotten one of those in 20 years. And I just thought that was a very thoughtful thing to do. So I'm just growingly impressed. Let me just say that.
Add something. He's been very active on Twitter also.
Yes, he has. And he sends a lot of stuff out on Facebook.
Oh, he is on Facebook.
He's on Facebook, yeah. And, you know, a lot of things that he'll send out to the clergy and, you know, I want you to know this, or, okay. That he doesn't want to send, you know, other ways.
Will this be his first confirmation as bishop here?
His first one here, yeah.
Not in the diocese.
Not in the diocese, no, okay. No. When we do the consecration of Blessed Redeemer this next month, that will be the first one of those he's done. When I went to Norm DeRozier's installation as rector, that was the first one of those that he has done. So,
how old was that?
It was very cool. And I think, you know, since it was his first one, I know it wasn't a canned speech, sermon. But I thought what he had to say to the congregation was spot on. It was not the service out of the prayer book, which we're not using anymore. My service here was not that. And a part of the prayers and all that sort of stuff at the beginning, the bishop began his sermon do you really believe what you said? Are you actually prepared to stand up and do? You have prayed mighty tall prayers. Are you really prepared to live up to them? And I mean, I'm kind of going like, I'm glad I'm not a member of this church. But it was good. And I think he's a very prayerful man. I think he has a very different skill set than Bishop Howe. And you all know I love Bishop Howe. As much as I love Bishop Howe, he was an extreme introvert. And, you know, since you all have the great fortune of having an extrovert for a rector, you know, I don't have an introverted cell in my body, it's interesting. Statistically, 80% of the Episcopal clergy are introverts, so it's not surprising we have a lot of introverted bishops. But I just, you know, when I'm with people, I'm engaged and my batteries are charged, and I just love to be in big masses and throngs, and you know, I just kind of suck the energy from those environments, and I just say, oh, this is, it's just so cool to be here. And I know people who, after one service and greeting people, I know a lot of clergy who don't greet people after the 8 o'clock service because they have no emotional energy left for the rest of the day. And so they just kind of come, do their thing, and walk out, go sit in their office. I'm not that way. Anyway, moving right along. So there'll be prayers for confirmation, reception, reaffirmation, and the bishop will pray for each of you individually. And then after that's over, one of the things that I would like for you to think about, pray about, whatever, is I like the whole notion of people in the service not being the observers. So I would really like for you to think and pray about what you would like to do in the service. Here you're saying, you know, I'm recommitting my life to the Lord and all that sort of stuff. And if one of you wants to read one of the lessons or lead the prayers of the people or be a chalice bearer or a whatever, I'd like for the people in the service to participate in a very active way. So y'all can think about what you'd like to do. And if you just want to sit in the pew and smile, that's okay. But I think it's a golden opportunity to have the words and the actions match. So let's see. After that, exchange of the peace, the celebration of the Eucharist, and then we come over for a reception. Well, there are going to be other people here. We have a woman, some of you know, Kathy Faunin. She has Parkinson's, and just within the last few months has moved over into a mother-in-law apartment at her daughter's house in Ocoee, Florida. But her granddaughter was baptized at St. David's 20-ish years ago. And she's gone through confirmation instruction. But in the process of all of that, her family moved. And so they're not going back to the old church where she went through her confirmation instruction. So she's tagging on, and she will be confirmed on behalf of the Bishop of Southern Virginia. So I think that's the diocese, wherever Williamsburg is. Yep.
There's no first Holy Communion.
Actually, there is. It's more done congregation by congregation. Let me tell you the difference in thinking between the Roman Church and the Episcopal Church on that issue. When we shifted from the 1928 prayer book to the 1979 prayer book, one of the shifts was the whole issue of openness to communion. Under the 28 prayer book, you had to be confirmed. Okay. So if you were not confirmed, you could not receive, regardless of how old you were. When we moved to the 1979 prayer book, we redefined baptism. It was a very sneaky theological thing. I wish they'd have been more upfront about it. But what we say about baptism is full initiation by water and the Spirit into the body of Christ, which is the church. If baptism is full initiation, regardless of when it's done, as infant, toddler, teenager, adult, then if you are fully initiated, there should not ever be a time when you are not welcome to be a part of the body of Christ. It's interesting that we can go historically into some of the earliest liturgies, and I'm talking 3rd century, not post-Reformation. And there will actually be handwritten rubrics in the missals, the books that the clergy use, that says after the child is baptized, when the people come up for communion, the priest is to dip his little finger in the wine and let the baby suck the wine off his finger. Okay, understand the symbol. Okay, we don't ever want this child to remember a time when they weren't welcome. Okay? So while a lot of larger churches have something that they even call First Communion, what we tend to do nowadays is we say to people, you know, when we have visitors or whatever, I'll always kneel down and ask the child their name, and then turn to the parents and say, does Johnny receive? Okay. And you can always tell when you get the deer in the headlights look. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. And so if I'm going to err, I'm going to err on the side of giving it to him. Okay. Now, let me explain my reasoning. It does not take me a whole lot to get into my 5-year-old tantrum stage, okay? And we all know that all men, I know women grow up and mature, but all men are basically spoiled 5-year-olds. And just ask my wife. And one of the things about spoiled 5-year-olds is that the only time they ever do this is when they're cold, when they're frightened, or when they're hurt. I don't want any of those acted out at the altar. Okay? So my druther and how we dealt with this with our 4 children, even when I served in diocese, that this was not the policy. My children were all baptized as infants. And I say my children because Lenore didn't want them baptized. She is a Baptist. That's where they make a commitment to Christ, and then they can do it. Well, you can hold on to that, but my kids are getting baptized. if you ever want to see Lenore smile, just say, I understand there's a slight disagreement between you and Father Scott on the issue of baptism. And don't plan on talking to anyone else at coffee hour that day.
I'm not getting her mad.
I don't either, you know. But anyway.
You get mad. It's one thing to get her mad.
Yeah. Our children always received. They were always welcome at the altar rail. And even when I went to serve in a diocese where that was not the policy, fortunately the rector agreed with me. So we just had the kids go somewhere else on the rare day when the bishop visited. But for me, I want... There's something about a child when you explain to them about what this really is, that they can go to awe and fascination like. I know it takes some adults years to come to that. Okay. So I would, you know, I'm one of those crazy people that I stress, I encourage, when Carter Densmore, I assume his name is Densmore, would come up to the rail, I saw, and again, this is what some churches teach their people, I'm not going to commune him, but if you want to give him a part of yours, I can't stop you. And I don't like that either. Think as a stubborn, spoiled 5-year-old. Do mommy and daddy ever get to eat and I don't get anything? Mommy and daddy are eating, I get to eat too. And if not, I will let you know about it. I turned to Willie and I said, he was reaching in the chalice, in the ciborium to get, one of the wafers. And I finally turned to Willie and I said, so how much longer do I have to say no? And of course, no, he is, I would assume. I don't know. But he's receiving communion on a regular basis. So we'll cover that piece. Again, for those of you who don't know me well, a lot of the reason I am the way I am is that I have a long litany of times when I was basically abused by the church or abused by clergy, and I don't mean sexually, but I can remember when I was confirmed. You couldn't be confirmed unless you were exercising a ministry. I'm a kid, what can I do? Okay, I'll be an acolyte. So I go through this 6 months of training, I have to go every Saturday, and I'm going like, oh my God, I got to walk to church on Saturday morning to go to, Lord, that's on top of the classes, everything else, this is torture. So anyway, I learned how to be an acolyte, and the first Sunday I was on duty, nobody showed up.
Oh, no.
So I had to be the crucifer, I had to be the torch, I had to do the server, I had to do everything. And 13 years old, And I went up to the credence table and I got the cruets out. They were silver in those days. We didn't use glass cruets. And I handed the priest, with great authority as I had been taught, and he poured the, and it was water. I had handed him the wrong cruet. And of course he knew it immediately and turned and gave me a dirty look. And when he came back, he handed me the water, took the wine cruet, and slapped me. And this was not a pat like the bishop gives. 13 years old. I was about the size I am now when I was 13. And I immediately started crying, took my vestments off, and walked out of church. I did not serve as an acolyte until I was in seminary.
Wow.
And I've dealt with a lot of clergy that I think God wound a little too tight. And I'm just like, you know, I take God seriously. I don't take a lot of other stuff seriously. And, you know, the Altar Guild, when I came here, I said, okay, here's my standard Altar Guild lecture. Altar Guild come in three versions. They come in the Golden Retriever version. They come in the Schnauzer version. And they come in the Rottweiler version. Do y'all get it? I said, I'm going to get along real well with all the Golden Retrievers. And I'm okay if we have a few Schnauzers, salt and peppered in. But I said, if we had any Rottweilers here, I just want to be real upfront and say, we're probably going to have problems. Okay? Because, you know, I somehow think if you run out of wafers or you pour the water first and not the wine, read Luke's gospel. Jesus screwed it up at the Last Supper. Have y'all ever noticed that? In Luke's gospel, they have the wine first before the bread. Obviously, it wasn't Episcopalian. But, you know, I think that so many of the things that people get upset about are really dogma. They're man-made stuff. It's not God's stuff. It's all man-made rules. So the man-made rules, I give wide berth and latitude towards. Let's head into church. And I want to show you all some stuff.
Give these back.
When you enter into the church, there's a vestibule that we call the narthex. Okay, we don't have one of those here. The closest it would come would be that one, the vestibule, kind of back there. The narthex is the place where people line up before church and get out of the rain and all that sort of stuff. It's in large churches, they have cry rooms, they have all that. Anything that is outside of the walls of the space where you worship can be referred to as a narthex. It's like an anteroom. Okay? When you come in to St. David's, if there was any way that I could get it physically closer, I would like the baptismal font to stand right about here. The reason baptismal fonts are at the back of the church is that they are to remind you of your baptism. For people who are a little more RC than I will ever be, we have little holy water things right here. And some people like to you know, dip their finger in that. Some make a sign of the cross, whatever. It's there if you want to use it. If not, don't pay attention to it, just like I don't. It's still going to be valid, but again, we try to bridge the gaps. But in most Episcopal churches, you will see the baptismal font is at the back. In most churches, it is not movable because it's stone. I love to tell the story at St. Paul's Chattanooga. One of my jobs and my fieldwork assignment was to work at this huge church, and I would have to deal with all the screaming little urchins. And we had all the kids come back, and they sat around the font. And my job as the seminarian was to keep them quiet. And so help me God, I was trying to silence one of the more obnoxious kids, and he was just a little more out of reach than I could grab. And they were at that very silent part of the service where the priest is just getting everything ready and he's going to dip the water, and the little kid says, "This is the best part. They pull a baby out of the rock." And of course, everyone in the congregation burst out laughing. But I'm thinking, from his perspective, he didn't see the kid go in, but he saw him be pulled out and lifted up, and he just assumed babies come out of the rock.
To this day, he's having problems adjusting to
reality. Yeah, for sure.
Oh boy.
The main part of the church is called the nave. Everyone who ever goes through an inquirer's class or a tour of the church with me, you will never forget this. If you want to see a more Rottweiler side of Father Scott, just refer to this space as the sanctuary. We do not ever call the church a sanctuary. In the Episcopal Church, sanctuary is what we provide for illegal aliens. Sanctuary is what we provide if you are unaware of U.S. Law. All churches are private property. If we were calling the fire department or the police department or an ambulance to come onto the property, we would have to have someone out at the street giving them permission to come onto the property. If the police knew that there was a convicted felon on the property, they could not come onto the property to get them. The church provides sanctuary, okay, but, and that's a pretty rare circumstances, we call this the nave, okay? Most churches, as St. David's is, we're sort of an upside-down barge, but most churches are built to resemble an upside-down boat, okay? And that's why, one of the reasons why the church is often referred to as the Ark. Okay? It does come from the same root word that navy comes from. It is a place of safety, okay, from the chaos of the ocean. The church is a place of safety, but not sanctuary. Sanctuary implies rest. This is not a place you come to rest. Okay, this is a place you come to worship. And if you've ever read about the worship experiences in the Old Testament, you knew that they were loud and noisy and there was a lot of stuff going on. Okay? It's not a place to come and kind of chill out and be quiet.
And you said at one point it wasn't until the 18th century that pews came in?
It's about the 1800s. Yeah, prior to that time, you stood in church. One of the reasons why many churches have the bells, okay, it's kind of a way of very simply saying, y'all shut up and quit talking and look up front because something important's going on, okay? So you'll notice we don't use them a whole lot because I make the assumption that you're paying attention. The church here has pews instead of folding chairs. Episcopalians like pews. We all know that that was God's intention all along. It just took him 1,800 years to get it in place. There's some simple rules. How do I know when to stand, sit, kneel, whatever? At St. David's, you can do anything you want. I don't care. As long as you're in the building, it's fine with me. Okay? You will notice I keep directions to a minimum. At 8 o'clock, I say, you know, please stand. But other than that, I don't say it. Okay? In the pews, and they're purposefully designed for you to be an audience. That was not the original intention. The original intention was, and in the Roman Church still is, after Vatican II, for people to be as close to the altar as possible. So all post-Vatican II architecture, you'll see, you know, a lot of churches in the round, all that sort of stuff. The idea is we want you up front, close, visible, paying attention. You want to have a kid misbehave? Sit in the back pew. You have little kids who you're, oh my God, I don't know, you know, I better sit in the pew. So when they act up, no, sit up front where they can see. They might pay attention. You can tell I'm okay with kids in church, as long as it's not quadraphonic stereo screening. This church was built in 1958. I finally have started reading the history. Prior to that time, it was a mission church. They bought this property in 57 after lightning struck the old one. Between 1958 and 2010, there wasn't a whole lot done around here. We've been playing catch-up the last 2 years. Anyway, that's a part of my fun and my joy. Then we get to this part of the church. From here forward, we call this the chancel. The chancel is anything behind the altar rail. At one time, the whole front area and the pews and everything didn't even look the way it does now. There used to be the choir pews up here facing each other. You know, the whole front was very different. And whoever designed this ought to be shot. I don't particularly care for it, but I'll live with it for a while. The altar rail is not intended for what you think it is. Altar rails came into the church in the 3rd century. They were made and installed initially to keep livestock from coming in and chewing on the altar vestments, the hangings on the altar. It was such that the pickets had to be close enough together that an animal's head could not stick through it. Because after Constantine, the church came into a period where they'd been underground and in hiding and secluded for so long, they actually built churches without doors on them. So livestock could come in and out as the people did. The altar rail is actually a vestige from the 3rd century. And it's interesting to note that starting in the 4th century up until the 11th century, if you knelt to receive communion, you could be excommunicated. Let me say that again. If you knelt to receive communion, you could be excommunicated. Listen to the church's logic. Whoever that is, you can name. The church's logic was, you have just confessed your sins, you've just been absolved by the priest, you now more so than any other time in your life are finally worthy to come to the Lord's table, and now you're still saying you're not worthy. Why? Interesting logic. Some people kneel because they think it looks holy. Really? Then why does the priest stand throughout the service? I don't know. What I say to people is, if you want to stand, stand. If you want to sit, sit. If you want to kneel, kneel. Who cares? That is an expression of your spirituality, not mine. Okay? If I had my way, everyone would stand. That's not going to fly here. In the Episcopal Church, since the 1979 prayer book, we try to have one place where the lessons are read and the sermon is preached from the same place. So the proclamation of the word is centered physically in one area. Do I like this pulpit? Survey says no. How I'm actually used to preaching is from a music stand, standing right here. And one of these days I'm going to go back to that. This has been my, I'll give on this issue for a little bit, but I don't really like it. This seems aloof, removed, whatever. This is, I can connect with you and talk with you as your spiritual leader from this place with exactly the authority. You can't see me any better there than you can see me here. I don't get it, but it was trying to keep somebody happy. This banner, I always talk about, it's been at this church for a long, long time. This little animal is a sandpiper, and on the back, I'm not sure what that is.
An egret and a turtle.
An egret and a turtle.
Yep.
And whatever. This was actually made by people here at the church. I'm not sure all the people who were involved, so I dare not mention selective names. But it's been here for a long, long time. These torches recently got mounted properly. The reason that these are here is because they're pretty. We want them off the floor, and they're meant to give light to whoever's reading or preaching. Candles, a lot of people think, look and sound real holy. They came into the church, as most everything does, for a practical reason, and then we add all kind of meaning on top of it. Okay, like, you know, the candle, these are the Eucharistic candles, and they're typically on the altar. Whenever these candles are lit, you know we're having communion. If you come in and the candles aren't on the altar, they're not lit, somebody didn't forget about it, you're not having communion. That was a signal, okay? So literally, in churches that aren't used to having communion every Sunday, it's a big issue whether the candles are lit or not. we typically refer to this side of the church as the gospel side, this side as the epistle side. Why is that? Well, if we call it left or right, who's left or right? Yours or mine? Okay? Typically, this is where the gospel is read and preached from, on this side. If you have a lectern and a pulpit, which we used to have, but I've moved out, then it would be over here. But the rubrics of the new prayer book say that you are to read all the lessons and preach from the same place. Hymn boards. When you look at the hymn board, if it's in color, that means it's not in the hymnal. Okay, it's in the red book. Eucharistic candles. So this is the gospel candle, the epistle candle. Why are they there? So the priest could read the service. There, if you're ever trained to be an acolyte, you're taught that this is always the last candle lit and the first candle extinguished. There's a great spirituality among some acolytes that the gospel candle never stands alone, da-da-da-da-da-da. It just looks nice. But that's what the official stuff is. This is called a retable. Retable is in this church, basically, to put the office lights on. And the reason each of these also has a name, okay? This is terse, set, non. This would be, or excuse me, they basically stand for the hours of the morning services. Yeah. So this would be the candle that was lit for the 6 a.m. service, 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., 6 p.m., 9 p.m. Okay? So when you were passing by the church that didn't have doors and you wanted to know when the next service was, you don't have a watch, you could simply look at the candles and tell when the next office, the daily offices. Prayer dues, these are basically prayer desks from the French word pray do, to kneel to God. The other seating up here is just for acolytes. Missal, M-I-S-S-A-L. This is the book the priest uses when he's going off in tangents and not following the prayer book. The missal has different stuff in it for seasonal use. It's obviously called the missal stand. Typically, it lives on the altar. This I want to talk about. This is called a credence table. It has things on it which we believe. There are altar basins. You'll get to see those every Sunday. This particular thing, and I don't know exactly where it came from, but it looks old and it smells old, and I think it's cool. So that's why we started using it. It used to live in the sacristy. This actually has a couple of names. It can be called an ombre, A-U-M-B-R-E-Y. It can be called a tabernacle. Technically, a tabernacle is freestanding. An ombre is something that's mounted in or adjacent to the wall. In here, there are several things. I'll do show and tell. There's reserve sacrament. This is from the wafers that have been blessed at one of the services. This is consecrated wine. that has been consecrated at the services. There is a selection of oils. These have been blessed by the bishop in our church. And this is a fascinating little thing. It actually has three different compartments. And in each of them, there's a cotton ball, and it has oil impregnating the cotton. And on this, this is a very, very traditional one. The bottom one is OI, oilatum intinctum, which is oil of intinction. This is what you would use if you were going to be anointing someone who was sick. Okay? The next one, which is improperly done. But there are three oils. One is for baptism, one is for the sick, and one is when you are going through a formal period of instruction. In very high churches, when we began the inquirers classes, you would have been asked to come forward, kneel, submit yourself to a period of instruction that used to be called the catechumenate, and there was an anointing oil for a person engaged in a rigorous time of study or instruction. We were anointed before I went to seminary for similar kind of purposes. And the oils, this is called an oil stock, is typically kept in the reserve sacrament in the tabernacle. We also keep a private communion kit, all stashed, served, and ready to go. So you can see what one of these looks like, if you've never seen one. There's little teeny linens. There is a small vessel of wine that has been consecrated. There is a this particular thing is called a Pyx, P-Y-X, good Scrabble word. It's a portable ciborium. There's also a little teeny chalice, a little teeny paten. And my liturgics professor hated these with a passion and called them doll communion kits because everything is miniature. Some people use the full-size stuff when they leave the church. But a part of the reason that we do this here is when you need a communion kit, you tend to be doing it in a hurry, and we don't want to have to stop and worry, is there one ready? There's always one ready in the sacristy. And you're saying, well, why would you be there in a hurry? What's the big deal? Whatever. There are some people who a part of their spirituality is receiving communion before they die. It has a very technical term. You may have heard that priests give last rites. Well, one of the last rites is a viaticum, which is your last communion on earth. So to be respectful of those people's spirituality, we do keep that here, ready to go, and have had to use it quite a lot recently. This particular sanctuary candle, they are typically red, have red globes. Some of them are clear. This particular one used to hang over there, and we're not real sure where we're going to put all this stuff just yet. So it hasn't been formally mounted. But it will technically hang probably right about there. It has a hanger. We just haven't got it put up yet. You will notice a lot of people, when they come into the church, they will bow kind of like this, or some people may, you know, genuflect, whatever. The reason people do that is not to honor the altar. It's not to bow to the cross. If you're going to bow to anything, you should be bowing here. Okay. The reason that you are used to bowing straight forward is, in most churches, that sits right here. Okay. Or it was built into the altar when the altar was up against the wall. Okay? So if that is a part of your spirituality, you need to understand you might want to bend this way instead of that way to have it be more correct.
Is that your bowing to the body of Christ?
That is honoring the Lord's presence and the reserved sacrament. Exactly. There is typically a cross here. We have some people who don't read the Altar Guild manual. And it's supposed to be left out, but somebody decided to put it away. Because, God forbid, we're going to lock this place up like the Fort Knox, but they're still going to get in and steal our brass-plated cross. I don't get it. But anyway, let's protect it, be careful, but it's here to be used. And when people walk into the church and it looks naked, I don't like that. So eventually, I'll get my way, but it might not be real soon. Are there any other things in the church that you see or wonder about, or kind of... I think I've covered most of the high points. This over here is the sacristy, which is kind of like the kitchen. For the altar guild. This should be a vesting sacristy, but right now things have been kind of a mess since I've been here. Not because I decided to rip it up, which I've been known to do, but because shortly before I got here there was a huge leak in the sacristy, and it ruined some cabinets, and we've got quite a nice collection of mold and mildew in there right now. So we're going to be doing some more extensive work in that area, but not right now. I think that's the end of the tour. We are going to... the last of the kneelers is being finished. As I speak, Barbara Fidler is doing the background for the last kneeler. And the next thing that's going to happen is these are all going to be taken out, taken apart, blocked, you know, remade. And when they're reinstalled, they're not going to look like they do right now, which is pillows kind of haphazardly cast along. They'll probably be mounted on the board, and they'll be nice and square and support you when you kneel and all of those other things. But it's been a long time coming. I understand they've actually been in process for about 20 years. So it's nice that we're on the last one.